Today, Scott and I, we kind of talked about whether or not we wanted to jump back into our study on euthanasia and suicide. And we thought, that might be kind of abrupt. It is July 4th weekend. A lot of people are gone, and this is kind of the season when people are starting to get back in. So we thought we would just kind of do kind of a discussion. You guys saw how we've been doing our podcast Sunday schools, right? So you guys are all going to be part of this podcast. It's actually going to be recorded, so make sure you progress. So I just have the discussion questions in front of you. Obviously, I think in the last 15 weeks, we've had a pandemic and this national moment of racial, I wouldn't say unrest, but racial discussion, probably serious as we've ever seen. So go on. So yeah, we got a hand up.
Okay.
So I thought it'd be good to just kind of debrief with you all and just kind of have an open discussion. So we can do pandemic first or the racial discussion first. Which one do you guys want to Well, yeah, they are. We're not talking about the Chiefs as much as I want to, but all right, we'll do pandemic. So I'm just kind of curious, no real right answer to this, but I mean, what life adjustments have you had to make during the pandemic? How has it kind of impacted you? Scott, I know we've had different experiences in the pandemic.
Yeah. So a couple of things. I know that it's for me, it's been worsened since the end of May, but just the change to your work schedule, staying at home, and then for teachers, for me, when school gets out, there's fewer opportunities to teach, some of the classes. So it's like this, how do you make the best use of your time? We saw that with our kids too. There are lots of activities that they're involved in, so they're just at home. Our previous normal was, school was at home, and then they had lots of activities at church and athletics.
Yeah.
So now they're more. So, one of the adjustments is, there's a lot more opportunity to sin against each other and be sinned against because we're just together, kind of confined for a lot of that time. And so just lots of training and discipline. Grace, lots of grace. I think just knowing that the challenge was knowing how to be hospitable, under those circumstances. How do you see your family or friends when you're kind of limited in what you're supposed to do in terms of social interaction? So calling people instead of meeting together in person.
Yeah.
There's a lot of those meetings, which were sometimes where the in-person meeting might be invigorating, that online might somewhat be draining sometimes. Just you kind of miss interaction.
That's good. Anybody else want to kind of weigh in on how the pandemic just kind of forced them to make some adjustments?
I think for me, when it all first started happening, I think some idols were exposed pretty quickly. That I have a lot of expectations on how things should be. And pretty quickly, it became evident that those were going to be dashed. So, how work goes, how church goes, how my social life goes, and things like that. So, I thought I was doing okay, and then I started talking to somebody about it, and then I was like, oh my gosh, this is a little more affecting me than I thought it was. But but it's been good because to realize that I need to be adaptable and flexible and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I'm a creature of habit. I like living the same week over and over again. Not day, week, Groundhog Week. So, yeah, that kind of forced me to do a lot of things. How about anybody else? Yeah, Catherine.
I'd say
getting used to being around your spouse all the time when we were just forced to be together quite a bit, and at times it got rocky, but learning to adjust and really go with him and spend time together, and it was a learning experience, I think, for both of us.
You want to weigh in on that?
Maybe he didn't notice it.
I thought it was great.
My things are great. It's awesome.
Oh, cool. We get to spend time together.
That's right.
It's fun.
Yeah.
David and I had probably a different experience than most people, because for us, like, everything stopped. And so it was actually a nice time because we couldn't go do anything. And I think if we wouldn't have had those 2 months, we wouldn't have been able to finish the house. And that was a huge blessing, selling the house. And so I went to part-time, which was really nice. I really enjoyed it. Just having more time at home and being able to really read my Bible more and do stuff like that. So, which I know is not the experience everyone else had. David worked full-time the whole time. So, I mean, looking back for me, I don't know how we would have finished the house by May if we wouldn't have had those 2 months to not go anywhere and only work on our house. But I also know that that's not the experience that everyone had.
Yeah. Anybody else want to weigh in?
I'm just kind of curious from everybody else's experience, where they're like kind of almost friends and neighbors and community question, but you know how it seems like your perspective would be very different whether or not you were able to continue working full time, you went to half time, lost your job, and I just didn't know if you knew if that was something that was in your circle of people that you're in contact with. Was I didn't like I'm amongst a lot of the teachers, you know, everyone still had their job, and how employment or loss of employment,
Josh,
see
did,
that as a big
Josh, did it impact you at all?
In our business it did, but not me and Cody's job. We both still worked full time. Cody went off for I think a month when it first hit, and then they right back to work. So
yeah,
but the business side,
the inflatables, kids bouncing around,
we took a big hit.
Anybody, did anybody actually lose their job? Or that's one thing I noticed, like Emporia has kind of been unique, where I think because of the essential businesses that we have and everything, we, I mean, I guess the restaurants and, like, hospitality and, like, what you guys do, that's been hit. But apart from that, I don't know of any real major, like, nail-biting economic downturn. Obviously, losing the Dirty Cans and the Glass Blend Open was a big blow to the restaurant and hospitality industry. But across the board, that's been the issue. Have you guys had how about conversations with just your friends and neighbors? I mean, what's been there? Experience, being able to talk to them about certain things.
I would say I've talked to a couple people during the pandemic about this, is that there's, especially amongst my coworkers that are unbelievers, is like you talked about your idols being shaken, but just this, there's this kind of belief that when man's at the top instead of God, there's this feeling, some of this overconfidence that we kind of have things figured out. We kind of have a hand on things. And so there's kind of this anxiety that stems from a lack of control and this desire to do what we can to control this virus. And so there's a lot of just this anxiety about what should we do? How should we do it? We've got to get our hands on around it, because, if we don't,
I think that's where a lot of this anger and contention comes to, because we should be better than this. And somebody should have an answer.
Right.
And nobody has an answer.
Yeah.
And it's, we're being, global economies being crippled by
the
virus.
I think the wealthier you are, the more that's your sentiment.
Yeah.
I did not go to college and get a professional degree so that I have to, so I can get COVID. There has to be something. Do you know what I'm saying? So there's kind of a, it's kind of interesting how the poorer you are, like the blue-collar workers, are more the ones who are like, that's just the way, I mean, life's hard, we're
And I think the further you are removed from death mm-hmm. and the reality of death and sickness, the mm-hmm. more difficult it is to face that reality.
Yeah.
And so I a lot of people that just see this life as, okay, we have all these modern medicine and doctors, so death is something that shouldn't happen ever mm-hmm. until you're 80. You know, it's like it just brings up this reality.
So we don't have to look at it.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's very unsettling to see death and be reminded mm-hmm. of our mortality.
Yeah, and it's interesting how a lot of the older people, they know they only have a few years left, and they don't want to spend their last year
right.
in quarantine, you know, away from their grandkids. So it's kind of been some real interesting reactions that I've noticed.
Yeah, I think in protecting old people, it's actually been hard on them because
yeah.
they don't have anywhere to go. Nobody can come see them. Mm-hmm. They're isolated.
Yeah.
And it's like been a worse life than if they
yeah.
maybe just...
Yeah, my wife's grandma, like the first month, we were like, we're not taking the grandkids over there. You got to stay home. We'll get groceries for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was like, I've had enough.
Yeah.
Bring me my grandkids. I don't care.
Right.
And now she's just acting like nothing's ever happened, which is kind of scary, but
mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, and I think that's an unusual dynamic, which is kind of surprising. Mm-hmm. Like, the older generation, we've lived through a lot. If we die, we die. I'm in my
yeah.
80s.
Like Curtis's grandpa, he had the last pandemic was the Spanish flu, and he's like, yeah, I had a sister that died from that, you know, however many years, 100 years ago or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, there's this calmness that it's not. Plus, you know, he's, like you say, he's in Presbyterian Manor, and so it's like, can't leave his room, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And, so it's this underlying difference of your life and your health versus your life, the big picture of
quality versus length of days.
Right,
yeah,
right. So he's, again, we've, you know, done a lot of talking to his forehead and the iPad. You know, he's got like long hair.
Really?
So, but, you know, they've trying to, you know, because he always has doctor's appointments. Can we take him to the doctor? I'm trying to find ways.
Yeah. Yeah, have you guys, what's been your read on just impact in the community of Emporia? Got to talk a little bit about the economic impact, but do you kind of have a sense of just where the community is with regard? I mean, what do you see, Sean?
I think it's highly divided from the people that are extremely paranoid to the people who extremely don't care.
Uh-huh.
And it's, I had a guy that used to work for me, he was, the minute they brought this thing out into the public eye, he was paranoid, just crazy paranoid. Probably go home and work from home right now. Yeah. So I haven't really seen that guy. I think
yeah.
he's in his basement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But then there's people that just absolutely, I mean, honestly, not that I don't care, but I haven't really changed my lifestyle. Other than just maybe being around more people. I've really got a tight-knit group that we hang out with, and that's about it. Outside of that, I haven't really changed anything I do.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Have you kind of seen the community respond in Chase County? I mean, what's it like in Chase County?
Oh, pretty normal.
It's like 98% of people just don't care, and then we have like 2% of people who are like extremists and like
yeah.
super care.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the majority of people, like, are acting like it's not even a thing.
Are these the people who moved in from out of town to get in touch with nature?
Yeah.
Are those
2%?
Those are the 2% who care.
Yeah.
Like, the people who, like, the lady who built Stonehenge?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
In Matfield, yes.
She's
I'll
one of
shake
those.
Shake hands in Chase County.
Yes.
Yeah,
I mean, like, in my office, I got so many phone calls, people just mad that they couldn't come into the courthouse and that they had to do their stuff. We actually installed a drop box at the back of our courthouse so people could drop stuff off.
Mm-hmm.
They were so mad at me that we were closed and da 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 da. And it was like every other phone call I just get a talking to about how mad they were. And I was like, I can't do anything. Literally the doors are locked. Like, this is not my decision.
Yeah.
All the commissioners. But, you know, most people were just mad. And or they wanted to come in and see people.
Yeah.
And they were mad that they couldn't. And we mm-hmm. have a fairly large population of elderly people. Mm-hmm. And it really, like the senior center shut down. Mm-hmm. And not shut down, but it closed. It's reopening now. But
yeah.
It was closed, and that was really hard on them. Mm-hmm. Because some of those people, that every day for lunch, that's where they go. Mm-hmm. And they sit and eat lunch and talk to all their friends. And they play bingo on Thursdays. And it was really, really tough on them to not be able to go.
Mm-hmm.
They've slowly reopened now.
Yeah.
So that's been good. But it was most people just didn't want anything to change. They didn't see a need for things to be different. They just wanted it to be normal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, like we drive a lot of places, and you know, Emporia had more cases, and you could come here and you could tell people were more mm-hmm. cautious or scared or whatever. Chase County, go to Hutch, mm-hmm. nothing ever happened in Hutch.
Hutch.
No one's wearing a mask.
They're defiant in Hutch. They're seriously.
So they, it's just interesting the different places you go, how people
are. And we did have a major outbreak here.
Yeah.
But yes, we'll be thankful for it later.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
I think we're seeing that now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What are our numbers at right now? Like
19.
Really, like 19 active cases or something.
Yeah, and two of them are in jail.
Yeah.
So you know that doesn't. You know what I'm saying? As far as like being a cluster that will impact us, it doesn't really count. You know.
Unless they let them out tomorrow.
Yeah. Have you guys seen ministry opportunities as a result of this? I know for us, we've had a lot more time to spend with our neighbors. So, we have some Paraguayan neighbors who, he's the conductor of the orchestra, teaches at the university, and she does music lessons, that they like have all kinds of free time now. And he's kind of, they're kind of concerned because if you can't have a crowd, then you can't have an orchestra and you can't have an audience. So I mean, it's definitely helped us as far as strengthening that relationship. And then two houses down, we basically have, I'm just going to call them a couple of Trumpers who openly get together outside in front of everybody. And they just have, they've had potlucks, parties in their driveway. They just have their kids. So it's kind of a funny dynamic where they're doing this, and then we have a woman who's actually named Karen who lives catty corner. She fits the stereotype. So it's been richly entertaining to see that dynamic. But it's been good because I've been able to get into a lot of good conversations with them. And the whole block knew that Becky had COVID, and so it became like, well, what happened? Tell us. And so that's kind of given us some neat ministry opportunities. Where
I'll share, obviously with all this time trying to find things to fill, so I've been reading more, and Carissa and I recently read through The Hiding Place, if you guys have read it, the Cory Ten Boom. And there's a part in there that I thought where she and her sister are getting into this concentration camp.
Yeah.
She was one that hid Jews in their home and were sent to concentration camp. And they went to lay down in this, this awful setting, and they were immediately covered in fleas. And what are we going to do? She and her sisters, remember what we read in 1 Thessalonians about, rejoice always, pray without ceasing, and give thanks in all circumstances. So let's give thanks. And they're finding things to give thanks for. They had smuggled the Bible in, and they had been they had a couple things, and she said, let's give thanks for the fleas. And she's like, we cannot do that, why would we give thanks for these? So if you guys know, as they're in there with the thousands of women, they're reading the scriptures, and more women are receiving and hearing the gospel and believing in this moments, days, and weeks before they die. She's always like, why don't the guards ever, they never broke us up, they would never come in and tell us to, they never messed with them. And she figured out, I can't remember how later on, it was because the guards didn't want to get the fleas. So that it kept the guards away from all these times of ministry to all of these women. And it was one of those things where the things that you think there's no way, like, okay, that's not really going to be used for good, you know, like, can serve to do a ton, as an integral part of some sort of ministry that God is going to do. And so there's a lot of those things that, you know, whatever the fights or the anxieties are or the virus brings, that was encouraging to me to just give thanks that God's in control of all things and that he's going to use things which appear to have no reason to accomplish a purpose.
Yeah.
You were talking about Becky. There was I had multiple people come into my office and start talking about how they'd seen on Facebook a pastor's wife had COVID and start talking about it, and I was like, that's my pastor's wife. That's that's Becky. I know her. That, you know, that they were kind of interested, and I was like, well, this is the church we go to. This is, you know, you can come meet her. but it was interesting. People I didn't really know. You know, it was really cool to see that. But
yeah, other things that you've seen? I think a couple of years from now, we'll probably see a lot of fruit from 2020. Yeah, that'd be part of somebody's story for a time of, where their sanctification really grew, or perhaps it came to Christ. I mean, yeah. I don't know. Any of you guys get any taste of that? Or seen those things, have conversations that you thought, wow. I know our website and our media presence has kind of gone up, but we'll see. Translating that into people actually coming to church and coming back, that's going to be a bit of a challenge.
My brother-in-law said that, you know, that it kind of forced their church to do things that they should have done 10 years ago, or, you know, audio, video, internet, like developing these ways to connect with the church and to have they
are
just put off to the side.
Yeah.
It just made it easier to talk about God with whoever you came in contact with, because, I mean, not that you always did, but like, there's kind of no explanation. It's just, you know, the Lord has it under control. And I mean, it kind of just come around to that a lot quicker than otherwise.
And it's not out of the blue to say that.
Right.
I think it's kind of like what Scott was saying. It brings mortality back to the forefront.
Yeah.
And so it's easier to have that conversation.
Yeah.
And just conversations, too, just about fear, things, trust.
Yep.
Yeah.
How important our health is.
Even at school, it was kind of, you know, kind of opened up opportunities for just conversations, because a lot of the administration was like, they were telling and guiding a lot of the teachers to just, you know, make sure you connect with and just listen to your students about how they're doing and what they need before you focus on the content. So, I mean, obviously the amount of content learning went down, but there was a lot more open discussion. How are you doing? How is your family doing? How's your parents doing? There were several students that I did get to know a lot better.
Yeah. So that's kind of one half of this. The other half is just, you know, this national discussion on racism. So I thought maybe just to kind of take some time to maybe just talk about that. Obviously, this is not, anytime you bring this up, right, there's some dangers in talking about racism. I mean, why is this an uncomfortable discussion for people?
You never know if you're right or wrong depending on the person you're talking to.
Yeah, flesh that out a little bit. Like, what are your concerns? Like, if you bring this up, this is a safe space to talk about this, by the way, so...
I think about talking about it with students and how do you approach it? Well, if obviously you want to give them a kind of clear picture so that they can decide, but are you going to accidentally say something where they're going to go home and tell their parent, maybe twist it of what you said, and then now you're the racist teacher, and then you got to go through and say, no, 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 that's not how it meant, or I don't, it's just...
Like you might be fired for saying all lives matter.
Yeah.
And realize that's a racist trope. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So yeah, I think that is, I mean, there's an element of fear, I think, in bringing up this discussion of saying the wrong thing.
I mean, there's an element of, in today's world, there is no absolute truth. The Bible is absolute truth, but not everyone believes that. And so we can't all agree on what is absolute truth. And so anytime you're having a discussion about racism or any of those other things, there's no absolute truth. So I can tell you, no, all lives are equal. And, you know, maybe you guys are being mistreated and maybe we need, you know, let's work on that, whatever. People will disagree on how you deal with that, because my absolute truth is the word of God. And he says, everyone's equal. So let's treat everyone equal. Well, that's not always good enough for other people who they believe that the absolute truth is that these people have been mistreated for so long, so now they need to be treated better than other people. And so you just have all of these different beliefs that are going on. And so each time you try to have a conversation with someone, you have to, first of all, figure out, what do you even believe, so that we can have a discussion about this. It makes it kind of complicated to have discussions with people, because you have to figure out exactly what each person believes about this movement and what's going on in the world. And, I also think, like, in America, we have a very sheltered life, because we are, I mean, we are very privileged comparatively. You know, I grew up in a third world country as a very privileged person in a third world country. And so sometimes it shocks me to see the stuff of what people in America consider the absolute worst of life, and to look back on, like, when we lived in Honduras, we had people that lived in the dump. Like, that's where they lived full time, was in the dump. And they would see us coming, white Americans, and they would follow us because our trash was better than everyone else's trash. So it's just very interesting to look at how people claim they're marginalized in America and then compare it to how people are marginalized in, and even in Central America, the more black you were, the more marginalized you were. And, like, the lighter-skinned black people were very rude and condescending to the darker-skinned people. So it's just a very interesting, I don't know, it's hard to have conversations about it, because you have to figure out, what are your experiences and what are you talking about and what's going on? And there's no absolute truth of where everyone's coming from.
Hey, Catherine?
Being friends with a lot of black teammates of whatever, it was a thing in the summertime, the black athletes didn't want to get darker than what they were, because that was a, they just wanted to be lighter. They didn't want to be darker.
I mean, why else is this kind of a difficult...
We're a very divided country, so it seems like everybody wants to be in a camp. So you're either in this camp or this camp. So if you disagree, then you're automatically put in a camp. And so instead of trying to have a discussion about it, it usually turns into yelling and screaming. And
there isn't a discussion. The discussion's been had. You're in the camp.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's hard to have a discussion. And the other danger is that we make that the pinnacle of sins, racism.
I think one thing that we talked about a little bit and that I've been dealing with is that how, like, what I think what you're saying, not to make it something the pinnacle of sins, is that when you, when I talk to or listen, try and listen as close as I can to a lost or an unbelieving person talking about how evil something is, it's hard to, like, because they have this, oftentimes, this assumption that man is neutral or good to begin with, what they think of when they think of evil is so far different that for me to have that discussion, it's almost like trying to explain that if one, it's more evil than you think it is. I'm not making less of it, I'm making more of it. And that's just a symptom of a much, much worse underlying evil heart. And I think that's super offensive, but also a great opening to the gospel to say, I'm not making less of this. What I'm saying is that this is one of many fruits of this sinful heart that's bearing this fruit. And that, you know, my solution is to deal with the root, you know, and focus on the gospel. And so trying to focus on the gospel as addressing man's greatest need is kind of the part where I'm trying to focus and learn how to do without negating real
suffering.
The unfortunate suffering that people thing have. Is, though, that Christianity has been so tied to slavery.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right? So it's difficult to have that conversation unless you can, you know, because they see that the Bible was used as an oppressive tool, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So in America, at least, I'm sure the colonial Britain and all of that, but to get past that is a major barrier, and having that conversation have any meaning, because they almost will like that is off the table.
Yeah,
you cannot use that. You know, when we know that that's really the solution.
Yeah, I'm going to be preaching 1 Timothy chapter 6, talks about slaves and masters. So that's going to be the time when I think it's going to be more appropriate for me to address that and that history. And honestly, the slavery in Antebellum America, I mean, it was just straight out wicked. I mean, people talk about racism and slavery being the original sin of the U.S., and you know, that was something that I think is true. I mean, there's a lot of other great things about the U.S. I mean, I'm troubled by the abortion holocaust, too. But that's institutionalized, by the way. I think for me, one of the reasons why this is very difficult to discuss is I want to ask the question, so what is it that you want? You know what I'm saying? What do you want? Do you want to end police brutality? Let's talk about that. But if you want like permanent white penance, I don't see how that's helpful. And I would even say that's destructive spiritually, because you have to pay penance. I mean, does any idea of penance that's at the root of multiple false religions? You know what I'm saying? That you are always in debt, you're always guilty, and I mean, I kind of talk about false guilt. There's no redemption, yeah.
I think, too, a couple things about just the overlying, like you're saying, how there's this no absolute truth, like the kind of the pervasive overview of the world. There's one is there's a increase, it seems like, in the, at least in the States, of this, kind of one of the foundational premises of like a Marxist view. Is that all people are either the oppressed or oppressors.
Mm-hmm.
And so you view, everything is viewed through the lens of, is this person an oppressor or the oppressed? And so that shapes every single discussion. And I think at the same time, you know, we've talked about there, over the last maybe 60, 70 years, there was a time when there was kind of a cohesive, you know, before the postmodern, you know, there was a truth. Scientific. Then you get to the postmodern, but what you almost turn the corner, because once you fully reject absolute truth, there's this vacuum that gets filled, and the absolute truth becomes whatever the state truth is, or whatever the
it's community constructed. Yeah,
community, right? And so people realize that we all live under an absolute. We believe things are our absolute truth, but when we jettison biblical truth, we cling on to something else instead. So we've seen. And you know, you may have seen there was a time where many voices that were claiming for, you know, just freedom to express individually, once that's achieved, now it's collective. Now it's any dissenting voice is, you know. Yeah. And so at the same time, there's a sense of long-term looking at and realizing that the church, you know, goes through times of, you know, peace and times of persecution. And just being prepared that we can't just blindly hope that, well, pretty soon everybody's going to see the light. You know, we have to be kind of be prepared for more harsh criticism, you know, more rejection. More.
Yeah. I mean, so what are the benefits of talking about this?
I think self-examination is always good. I mean, it causes an individual self-examination, but a corporate self-examination in a way, too. I mean, there is a legacy of racism in the church, especially, I mean, you're like...
Southern Baptist. God bless them. Yeah. But yeah. And they would admit, they'd own that, yeah. Admit that.
Right. So, you know. But the conversation is what is difficult to have right now because of critical theory and things like that, where you cannot have that conversation if you are in the oppressor group.
Yeah. You can only listen.
They dictate the terms, and so and then there's no end. There's no end to it. So that's not really helpful. So because of our current philosophical and, you know, thought, it just seems like a stalemate right now.
Yeah.
I think one thing that there is, when I think about benefits and, like, your, over time, when people that sharply disagree or reject the things that you say, if those are people that you see day in and day out, and they witness you being consistent and kind and loving and living out the Christian character, there's a lot of hope that, you know, one, they may be increasingly hardened, and that may result in further rejection, but there are times where people have been won over through the witness of your life, oftentimes through just your loving commitment to Christ, and then there's an acceptance of the truth later on as they turn and recognize their sin. So I think there's benefits of being able to voice your opinion in a loving way, face to face, and be okay with being spurned or reviled. Or
I have a hard time. I mean, like, especially with like the really extremists who are like saying that, well, all white people should pay penance for what their sins have. I have a hard time trying to talk to people like that, because if you look back in history, it wasn't just white people who were putting other people into slavery. I mean, the people coming from those countries on the boats were black.
And before,
and they were putting, I mean, and
this isn't a 500-year-old sin.
No, it's thousands of years, and it wasn't just white people putting black people into slavery. And then when you look at it, who were the people that got the black people out of slavery? So it's a, I have a really hard time talking to people who are extremely on the extremist side, because it's always just black and white in their eyes. The white people were bad and black people were oppressed.
Are these white people saying that?
No, I mean people of color. You just have these, it's just difficult to be like, well, no, if you actually look at history, and I'm not saying it wasn't right, you know, it was not right. It was sin. That's almost saying that isn't enough. You can't just say.
Yeah, I think I think part of this is exposed the faulty mediums of these discussions.
Yeah.
I kind of have a policy where I don't argue on the internet. I never do. I've done it twice. I don't know why I did it the second time. I was just an idiot.
Just to be sure.
I never do it.
Yeah. I know this is,
but I think there's important. There's a big difference between sitting down with somebody and saying, listen, racism is deplorable. I mean, have you guys ever seen like true racism in action? I mean, there have been times where I've seen, and I was stunned. I was like, people really think this way? You know, so that's like a reality that every once in a while I'm able to look into and see it. I don't have, that's not my lived experience. You know what I'm saying? So I think there's something to be said for, I don't understand what it's like to be a black man in the U.S., nor do I want to pretend to. You know what I'm saying? So I think part of it is, you know, you can think globally but act locally. I mean, there's, you know, what can we do here instead of trying to, you know, no tweet that we have is going to solve the national race problem. You know what I'm saying? There's just a certain, you know, you.
Certain yeah. group of people that they're a victim, they're the oppressed, and they want to stay that way.
Yeah.
And you can be, we have a family member, you can be kind, and you can, they don't care, you're still horrible because you're white. And so it's just like there's no amount of, I mean, maybe like in years, you know, you have to trust the Lord, I guess, but kindness yeah. and it just gets really tiring to always be the bad guy.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's something where Jesus was a bad guy. That's why he crucified him.
Yeah.
So I think there's a benefit to one of the self-examination, just trying to understand being compassionate, right? Owning racism is a sin. I want to have compassion for you. And that's a much easier conversation to have with people individually. And just making it clear that, like, I don't comment on any social thing online. So like I said, I don't do any of it. I think the other thing is, what's easier, to go from talking about racism to the gospel or baseball to the gospel? Baseball? Yeah, you can just go right, you know, it's a home run, right?
I don't know.
You know what I'm saying? So to a certain extent, the fact that there is a national discussion about this isn't something we should shy away from.
Yeah, it's like I think what you said, what do you want? I think that there is value in saying, okay, let's work on what can we do? What can we do? And try and get to the heart of, do you think that's going to solve the real problem? And that's where you can have some real disagreements. I feel like the problem is deeper than what you say. I think sometimes it's kind of flipping things around. Sometimes people that are light-skinned, white-skinned are viewed as making too little of the problem. So I think you can oftentimes flip that around and say, actually, I think the issue is much deeper or worse issue than you're leading on. And just kind of bringing in the gospel and making it, because when you talk about a lot of the issues that are on the surface, it's really, again, it's a fruit of a deeper issue that they're having a conflict about. And so if you kind of stay away from this level of arguing.
Yeah.
Try and argue it.
It's much more profitable to have intimate conversations. It's much more difficult to despise somebody face to face than it is.
Yeah, it is.
You know, or at your protest, or
right.
And I'm not saying you shouldn't be protesting. I'm just saying when it goes back to these camp mentalities, these kind of mob mentalities, the message gets lost because all we see is the
And I think we're kind of at a unique point too, as well, where during the quarantine, that aspect was multiplied because you've seen how people are 1,000 times worse online than they would be face to face, and so people were, number one, removed from all their face to face interactions, and they had a lot of time to focus on just their online interactions. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's, in one sense. It's going to be, you know, you're hopeful that, you know, I can imagine somebody having this crazy online disputes the whole 3 months, and now they're back at work together.
Not to be in the same room together.
So you're hopeful that, you know, you're honorable, and you either stayed away or spoke in a way that now that you're face to face, you're not going to be embarrassed or ashamed of how you spoke to those people.
Yeah, I think a great passage to bring up is Titus 3:3. For we ourselves were once foolish, disobedient, led astray, slaves to various passions and pleasures, passing our days in malice and envy, hated by others and hating one another. Like, isn't that just the heart of racism? Right? Malice, envy, hatred. And you know, so it's like, what's Jesus' disposition towards a racist? Is it to turn around and oppress them? Well, but when the goodness and loving kindness of God our Savior appeared, he saved us not because of works done to us by done by us in righteousness, but according to his own mercy, by the washing of regeneration, renewal of the Holy Spirit, whom he poured out on us richly through Jesus Christ our Savior. So, I mean, that would be, you know, somebody's a professing Christian, it's like, well, what should our heart be towards racists? You know, let's agree that's a problem. You know, let's agree that there are truly racist people out there. That's why you read some of those stories about, you know, a black man befriending racist, talking to them and kind of winning them away from that. I mean, those are, I think, some pretty helpful narratives to go into. It's like, yeah, ultimately you just kind of win one racist at a time. And unfortunately, cancel culture, what it does is just drives people underground, and you're gonna breed a new generation of racists, people who feel like they have been wronged and they were cheated because of the color of their skin, right? But if a white person gets fired, I mean, that's going to create white nationalism and white supremacy. It's kind of the law of unintended consequences.
Pendulum.
Yeah, and that's the, I mean, if you know the Hegelian dialectic, you know, the back and forth, it just goes from one to the other. And with Marxism, there's this hope that eventually you'll reach that steady state. I think the other thing, too, that's kind of an interesting thing is, okay, what is meant by equality? What's meant by equality? Does it equal in outcome or equal in value? Like, look at the parable of the talents, right? He gives one 10, another 5, another 1, and no one really protests that. Like, the master has a right to do that. You know, so I think there's, that's another thing. It's like, okay, what do you mean by equality? It's another great discussion to have. Equality in outcome, equality in opportunities, equality in value. So are you telling me that somebody who has more financial resources is more valuable to God than somebody who doesn't? So maybe to society they are. I mean, wealth is, value is often measured in terms of wealth, but why do we choose that as the metric and not something else? So there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of discussions that we can have with other people, you know, by talking through the issue. Do you know what I'm saying? But it needs, but I think the face-to-face conversation is like the way it needs to be done. So, other thoughts?
Quite a few years ago, I had co-workers of multi-ethnicity and race.
Mm-hmm.
I just walked by one of them. It was a lot of slang involved between him and I. It was just him and I. It's all abbreviated. But mm-hmm. by the end of the conversation, we realized we're cool with each other. So it's kind of neat to
yeah.
realize that. And
Yeah. I mean, having a relationship. I even think understanding what's really offensive to people. Like, I heard a story of a pastor walking with a friend of his who was African American, and he sees this big pyramid of watermelons at the farmer's market and says, "Hey, you want to get some watermelon? I just love watermelon." And the black guy is like, "Okay." And then he just said, "You know, I just got to ask you, what did he mean by that?" Because, I mean, watermelons was part of a stereotypical character of, you know, of African Americans. You know, in the comic strips, it was a way of kind of making fun of them that they all want watermelon. And that pastor had no idea that that was the connotation, right? You know, so I think in any relationship, I mean, if you are a missionary, right, you got to be sensitive to what's offensive to other people. And it's, you know, love covers a multitude of sins. And that's the problem. When you have a politically correct culture where it's a means of punishing people and canceling people, that's a different story than, oh, it's okay, now you understand. We're good. You know what I'm saying? If some of the political correctness was accompanied with a little bit of grace and redemption and hope instead of a means of just putting people in bondage, I think we'd look at it a little bit differently. So, other thoughts? So next week we're going to go back to suicide and euthanasia. Nice uplifting topic. So Scott will be leading that. We do have some extra studies up here if you want to get a head start and look at it. But let me pray, then we'll break up. Well, Father, I do thank you for this discussion. I pray that it would be helpful as we talk about some of the war, yeah, the situations going on in this world. And I pray that we won't see the pandemic and this racial discussion as a threat, but really an opportunity to be able to speak truth to our friends and neighbors, and to give them the only sure hope that Jesus Christ is Lord, that he will come back one day, and that those who profess their faith in him and trust in him for their salvation will one day reign with him in the new world. We look forward to that day in Jesus' name.